Oliver Wendell Holmes sounded the principal theme of American jurisprudence of the 20th century when he said that moral preferences are more or less arbitrary. Do you like sugar in your coffee or don't you? So as to truth. The value skepticism of 20th century legal thought took two principal forms. The milder form is a murky utilitarian pragmatism, and this dominated American law schools from at least the end of World War II to the mid-1970s. The consensus of that era now has fragmented, but this remains the principal style of thought in the legal profession and especially in the Supreme Court of the United States. The second, more extreme form of skepticism sees law not as seeking the greatest attainable satisfaction of everyone's wants, but as the self-interested exercise of power. On this view, law is a matter of who gets what, of politics unguided by principle. Champions of both the mild brand of skepticism and the piquant brand, law is power, both claim Oliver Wendell Holmes as their champion. Which of the two competing views better captures Holmes' teaching is a matter of dispute. Was Holmes a pragmatist and a utilitarian, or was he a Nietzschean, a social Darwinist, or a nihilist? I think the more thoroughgoing skeptics have a stronger claim to his mantle. Holmes was certainly the most influential American legal thinker in the 140 years since the Civil War. He lived from 1841 to 1935. He was practiced law, was a professor at the Harvard Law School, was on the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts for 20 years, was on the Supreme Court of the United States for more than 30 years. He's remembered for his principal scholarly work is The Path of the Law, published in 1897, which articulates the prediction theory of law, the prophecies of what the courts will do in fact, and nothing more pretentious are what I mean by the law, and his bad man perspective on law. If you want to know the law, you must look at it as a bad man who cares only for the material consequences which such knowledge enables him to predict, not as a good one who finds his reasons for conduct, whether inside the law or outside it, in the vaguer sanctions of conscience. On the Supreme Court, he's remembered for some notable First Amendment dissents. He said the best test of truth is the power of a thought to find an acceptance in the marketplace of ideas, and for dissenting from Supreme Court decisions invalidating social welfare legislation, wages and hours legislation. The majority of the court thought that was inconsistent with freedom of contract, and Holmes dissented, not because he believed in social welfare legislation, but because he had this Darwinian sort of theory of judicial restraint that said the dominant power should have its way. If the people want to go to hell, I will help them. That's my job. Hymns have been written about this man. Benjamin Cardozo called him the great overlord of law and its philosophy, adding that Holmes is today, for all students of human society, the philosopher and the seer, the greatest of our age in the domain of jurisprudence. He is indeed the philosopher become king, declared Felix Frankfurter. For centuries, men who have never heard of him will be moving to the measure of his thought. Like the winged victory of Samothrace, he is the summit of hundreds of years of civilization, Charles Wazanski declared. His was the most distinguished mind of its time, said Henry Steele Cummager. The great oracle of American legal thought, said Thomas Gray. America's most distinguished citizen, said Carl Llewellyn. The only great American legal thinker, said Morton Horwitz. The most illustrious figure in the history of American law. Those are Richard Posner's words. As Harry Calvin and Hans Seisel concluded, for the American lawyer, he is the beau ideal. And Holmes may be the ideal of the public as well as of his profession, because he's the only Supreme Court justice to have been the subject of a best-selling historical novel, a hit Broadway play, and a motion picture. Despite these hosannas to Holmes, a common theme in writing about him is that he was two people, Jekyll Holmes and Hyde Holmes. As early as 1869, when Holmes was 28, William James declared that he was composed of at least 2.5 different people rolled into one, And the way he keeps them together in one tight skin without quarreling any more than they do is remarkable. 62 years later, when Holmes was a justice of the Supreme Court, Mortimer Adler said that it was necessary to separate the greatness of Holmes as a judge and a person from his highly questionable jurisprudential doctrines. Shortly after Holmes' retirement, H.L. Mencken wrote, "On at least 3 days out of four, the learned justice remained the soldier, precise, pedantic, unimaginative, even harsh. But on the fourth day, a strange amiability overcame him." In the 1940s and 1950s, the lay and clerical Catholic scholars emphasized the darkness of Holmes's jurisprudence. But even the critic who titled his article, "Hobbes, Holmes, and Hitler," announced in the opening sentence, "All Americans are proud of Mr. Justice Holmes." Daniel Burstyn wrote of Holmes' elusiveness, Al Tuster of his double-facedness, and Francis Biddle of his dualism. There are echoes of Jekyll Hyde dualism in the biography by Sheldon Novick. The frontispiece quotes Cardozo. "One cannot read Holmes' opinions without hearing honor and courage written down on every page." And most of Novick's description of Holmes is in accord with that. But the preface remarks that Holmes, in personal letters, seemed to espouse a kind of fascist ideology. You kind of wonder whether the letter writer and the judge were the same person. Richard Posner has said that that in this reference to fascist ideology, Novick has gone overboard, and maybe that's right. I mean, just the fact that a guy favors eugenics, glorifies war, and thinks that might makes right, that's no reason for calling him a fascist. Posner did observe that Holmes favored free speech and was a champion of democracy. People have applied a lot of other labels to Holmes: positivist, realist, social Darwinist, pragmatist, utilitarian, totalitarian, intellectual radical, liberal conservative, and a lot more. But maybe because the word wasn't current during Holmes's lifetime, almost no one has used a word that I think better captures his philosophy. Existentialism can be regarded as the view that human life is meaningless except insofar as it is invested with meaning through personal acts of will. Only an existential leap can overcome existential doubt, existential despair, and existential nausea. And on that view of the concept, I think Holmes was an existentialist. Both J.W. Burrow and Richard Posner have come up with another label that may be even more apt. One wants to murmur Nietzschean about Holmes's celebrations of war, intensity, heroism, and will. A letter from Holmes to Lady Castletown, an English peeress who may have been his lover, offered a one-sentence statement of his creed. "Nothing could be more enchanting than to see a man nearly killing himself for an end which derives its worth simply from his having affirmed it." In true postmodern fashion, Holmes called this style of commitment nonsensical and sublime. He wrote of the person able to lift himself by the might of his own will, unaided, able to face annihilation for a blind belief. He wrote of the divine folly of honor, which has no value but what one's own heart gives it, and of man's most peculiar power, the power to deny the actual and to perish. In an address in 1900, Holmes observed, "From the point of view of the world, the end of life is life. Life is action, the use of one's powers. As to use them to their height is our joy and our duty, so it is the one end that justifies itself." In these remarks, Holmes even read scripture as though the important part had been written by Friedrich Nietzsche. "I think whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, infinitely more important than the vain attempt to love thy neighbor as thyself." Holmes' concluding paragraph declared, "We are all very near despair, but these thoughts have carried me through long years of doubt, self-distrust, and solitude." Mrs. Holmes is supposed to have remarked that Wendell's latest plaything is despair. Although Holmes wrote that the end of life is life, he also wrote of suicide as the ideal expression of that illusory personal spontaneity or independence which exhibits itself in less marked form as consideration for the weak, charity for the poor, drunkenness, going to the play, painting pictures, etc. In short, uneconomic expenditure of force. Holmes' speeches never described law as a force for good. Law in Holmes' rhetoric was neither the bulwark of liberty the refuge of the oppressed, the source of order and stability, nor the guarantor of prosperity. He emphasized instead the intrinsic joy of legal work. I say that a man may live greatly in law as elsewhere, that there as well as elsewhere, he may wreak himself upon life, may drink the bitter cup of heroism, may wear his heart out after the unattainable. On Holmes' 90th birthday, he responded to a series of tributes in a memorable radio address. The riders in a race do not stop when they reach the goal. There is a little finishing canter before coming to a standstill. There is time to hear the kind voice of friends and say to oneself, the work is done. But just as one says that, the answer comes. The race is over, but the work is never done while the power to work remains. The canter that brings you to a standstill need not be only coming to rest. It cannot be while still you live. For to live is to function. That is all there is to living. Well, viewing life as a race or a contest, an occasion for functioning and nothing more, was a basic Holmesian theme. When Yale awarded Holmes an honorary degree in 1886, he responded, "I never heard of anyone who professed indifference to a boat race. Why should you row a boat race? Why endure long months of pain in preparation for a fierce half hour that will leave you all but dead?" Does anyone ask the question, is life less than a boat race? At a law school dedication in 1902, Holmes observed, "Art, philosophy, charity, the search for the North Pole, the delirium of every great moment in man's experience, all alike mean uneconomic expenditure, mean waste, mean a step toward death." Holmes remarked that an explorer's account of his search for the pole rather loses than gains in ideal satisfaction by the pretense of a few trifling acquisitions for science. Holmes suggested that athletics had a eugenic goal. The purpose of athletics was to build a stronger, tougher, better human race. "I rejoice at every dangerous sport which I see pursued. The students at Heidelberg with their sword-slashed faces inspire me with sincere respect. I gaze with delight upon our polo players. If once in a while in our rough riding a neck is broken, I regard it not as a waste, but as a price well paid for breeding a race fit for headship and command." So for Holmes, life was a horse race, a boat race, a trek to the North Pole, a duel with swords, a neck-risking game of polo. It might even be a game of cards. "Why do I desire to win my game of solitaire?" A foolish question, to which the only answer is that you are up against it. Accept the inevitable and do your damnedest. Leo Strauss once said of Max Weber, that he transformed the command, "Thou shalt have ideals," into the command, "Thou shalt live passionately." Strauss wrote, "One may call the nihilism to which Weber's thesis leads noble nihilism." And you could say that of Holmes as well. William James offered this comment, "I'm disappointed in O.W.H. for being unable to make any other than that one set speech which comes out on every occasion. It's all right for once in the exuberance of youth to celebrate mere vital excitement, la joie de vivre, as a protest against humdrum solemnity, but to make it systematic and oppose it as an ideal and a duty to the ordinarily recognized duties is to pervert it altogether. Mere excitement is an immature ideal, unworthy of the Supreme Court's critical endorsement." Holmes sometimes spoke of judging in terms of weighing considerations of social advantage, but he valued personal action for its expressive and not its instrumental qualities. Individual action was admirable to the extent that it was uneconomic. The less functional an action, the more it became sublime. Blind commitment alone gave meaning to life. And it didn't matter whether this commitment found expression in art, charity, exploration of the Arctic, a legal career, a boat race, a game of solitaire, or suicide. Well, the ability to affirm a game-like end and make it one's own, the ability to function is what gave life its meaning. Apart from that, existence for Holmes was apparently a void. My bet is that we have not the kind of cosmic importance that the parsons and philosophers teach. I doubt if a shudder would go through the spheres if the whole ant heap were kerosened. I see no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand. I wonder if cosmically an idea is any more important than the bowels. I think that the sacredness of human life is a purely municipal ideal of no validity outside the jurisdiction. I believe that force, mitigated so far as may be by good manners, is the ultima ratio. Every society rests on the death of men. Now, Holmes had values, or at least he said he did. He called these values his can't helps. As I probably have said many times before, all I mean by truth is what I can't help believing. I don't know why I should assume, except for practical purposes of conduct, that my can't help has more worth than any other. I can't help preferring pork to ditch water. But I see no ground for supposing that the cosmos shares my weakness. I demand of my philosophy only to show that I am not a fool for putting my heart into my job. Holmes observed, our tastes are finalities. And so, port over ditch water and sweet coffee over bitter, Holmes had his can't helps. But you know, apart from his personal passion, it was awfully difficult to figure out what they were. They included few charitable or political causes. Blackstone, whose view of natural rights has contributed to his current disfavor, contended that everyone has a right to life, including a right to a sufficient supply for all the necessities of life. Holmes maintained, as to the right of citizens to support an education, I don't see it. It may be a desirable ideal to aim at, but I see no right in my neighbor to share my bread. I mean moral right, of course. There is no pretense of any other, except insofar as, in combination with others, he has the power to take it. Holmes is committed to living passionately, but he disparages most passionate commitments. John Dewey talks of the exploitation of man by man, which always rather gets my hair up. All society rests on the death of man. When my law clerk talks of more rational methods of resolving international disputes, I get the blood in my eye and say that war is the ultimate rationality. I never read a socialist yet from Karl Marx down that I don't think talk drool. The notion that we can secure an economic paradise by changes in property alone seems to me twaddle. If you think I'm going to bother myself again before I die about social improvement or read any of those stinking onward and upwarders, you err. I mean to have some good out of being old. Holmes apparently could not envision any basis for political, social, or personal action other than self-interest. He wrote, the condition of others is primarily their business and certainly is beyond our power, whence the futility of the command to love one's brother as oneself. He also said, I don't see why we mightn't as well invert the Christian saying and hate the sinner but not the sin. Hate imports no judgment. Disgust is ultimate, and therefore as irrational as reason itself, a dogmatic datum. The world has produced the rattlesnake as well as me, but I kill it if I get a chance, as also mosquitoes, cockroaches, murderers, and flies. My only judgment is that they are incompatible with the world I want, the kind of world we all make according to our power. Holmes's can't help certainly didn't include religious belief. His dismissal of pragmatism was abrupt. I now see that the aim and end of the whole business is religious. Moral principles had no firmer grounding than religion. I said to a lady at dinner the other night that morals were a contrivance of man to take himself seriously, which means that the philosophers make them an end in themselves, an absolute matter, and so an excuse for their pretension to be on the ground floor and personal friends of God. For Christians, a touching passage of scripture is Simeon's prayer. Here's this old guy who's been promised that he will see the Messiah, and he holds the infant Jesus. I think his prayer is appropriate for anybody of advancing years who looks on a child. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles and the glory of thy people Israel. Well, at the age of 88, Oliver Wendell Holmes revealed that he'd lost neither his toughness nor his sense of humor. He remarked that his wife's death not only takes away half of my life, but gives me notice, and remembered Simeon's prayer and wrote, O Cosmos, now lettest thou thy ganglion dissolve in peace. Holmes's can't helps did not include a belief in natural justice or innate human rights. I take no stock in abstract rights, he said, and equally failed to respect the passion for equality. He wrote to one of his correspondents, you respect the rights of man. I don't accept those things a given crowd will fight for. On another occasion, he observed, all my life I have sneered at the natural rights of man. The first inalienable right articulated by the Declaration of Independence was life, but the founders' self-evident truths were not among Holmes's can't helps. In 1929, Holmes dissented from the Supreme Court's ruling that Rosika Schwimmer, a well-known pacifist, could not be a citizen of the United States. Schwimmer had refused to swear that she would bear arms in times of war. As Holmes explained in the letter, she wouldn't do what the law wouldn't allow her to do. There's a federal statute that demands a pledge to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and the court says that precludes Schwimmer's naturalization. Holmes's dissent spoke eloquently for freedom of the thought we hate, and then, commenting on Schwimmer's pacifism in a letter, he revealed how much he did hate the thought. What damn fools people are who believe things. All isms seem to me silly, but this hyper-ethereal respect for human life, perhaps the silliest of all. He'd addressed the same subject in a letter to Dean Wigmore. Doesn't this squashy sentimentality of a big minority of our people about human life make you puke? That minority includes people who believe there's an onward and upward, who talk of uplift, who think that something in particular has happened and the world is no longer predatory. Oh, bring in a basin. Well, somebody who adopts this skeptical posture may find it difficult to affirm a belief in any cause. Confronting the plausible says who's of others diminishes the ability to fire says who's oneself, and Holmes eliminated the obvious candidates for a list of self-help, can't helps. But Holmes's list was not entirely empty. He stood squarely for an expressive rather than instrumental jobism and for the glory of struggle and war. When men differ in taste as to the kind of world they want, the only thing to do is to go to work killing, he said. He wrote on another occasion, war is not only not absurd, but is inevitable and rational. And oh yes, Holmes had one more belief or can't help, his starting point for an ideal for the law. I believe that the wholesale social regeneration, which so many now seem to expect, if it can be helped by conscious, coordinated human effort, cannot be affected appreciably by tinkering with the institution of property, but only by taking in hand life and trying to build a race. That would be my starting point for the ideal, for an ideal for the law. Many of Holmes' statements on race building seem chilling, especially in light of later history. He wrote of substituting artificial selection for natural by putting to death the inadequate, and of his contempt for socialisms not prepared to kill everyone below standard. He declared, I can imagine a future in which science shall have gained such Catholic acceptance that it shall take control of life and condemn at once with instant execution what now is left for nature to destroy. He spoke of the possibility of future generations with smaller numbers, but perhaps also bred to greatness and splendor by science. And he wrote, I can understand saying, whatever the cost, so far as may be, we will keep certain strains out of our blood. In 1941, Father Francis Lucey noted one of Holmes's statements concerning eugenics. I'm struck by the date of this statement, 1941. Holmes had said, I shall think socialism begins to be entitled to serious treatment when it, and not before, it takes life in hand and prevents continuance of the unfit. Lucey remarked that if recent reports are true, the socialist state in Germany appeared to satisfy Holmes' standard for serious treatment. Well, Richard Posner has noted that belief in human eugenics was a staple of progressive thought in Holmes's lifetime. Posner added that although people now consider Holmes's eugenic enthusiasm shocking, with the renewed interest in euthanasia and the rise of genetic engineering, we may yet find those enthusiasms prescient rather than depraved. But in fact, Holmes's position went well beyond the conventional views on eugenics of his day. Lots of people favored the sterilization of the retarded. Lots of states passed laws requiring this sterilization. In what's probably his most notorious opinion, Buck against Bell, Holmes upheld the constitutionality of these laws with the words, three generations of imbeciles are enough. And 18,000 Americans were sterilized following this decision. And so you can find lots of people who favored forced sterilization, but you do not see anybody of note other than Holmes speaking favorably of putting to death infants that didn't pass the examination. And certainly eugenics was the only part of the progressive program that Holmes favored. Holmes' judicial opinions were for the most part consistent with his personal philosophy and his detachment. He was incapable of addressing questions of right and wrong, and so repeatedly substituted power metaphors for analysis. He reiterated in countless ways the Darwinian truism, winners win, or survival of the fittest, with the fittest being those who survive. What proximate test of excellence can be found except correspondence to the actual equilibrium of force in the community, that is, conformity to the wish of the dominant power? The foundation of jurisdiction is physical power. Law is a statement of the circumstances in which public force will be brought to bear upon men through the courts. The best test of truth is the power of thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market. I confess my inability to understand how a condition can be unconstitutional when attached to a matter over which a state has absolute arbitrary power. Well, Holmes died 70 years ago, but you see signs of Holmes of everywhere. Taxonomies of legal scholarship place both law and economics and public choice theory on the political right, and feminist jurisprudence, critical legal studies, and critical race theory on the left. All of these, the members of all these movements are the heirs of Holmes. On the left, critical legal studies movement takes as its motto, "Law is politics." Doesn't seem to refer to the politics of civic virtue. For the CLS scholars, politics is simply who you cheer for. The white male elite who wrote the laws cheered for themselves, and CLS cheers for their victims, and that's all there is to it. Many radical feminists and critical race theorists are also the heirs of Holmes. They deny the possibility of a principled response to the unprincipled subordination of minorities and women. Feminism does not claim to be objective because objectivity is the basis of inequality, writes Ann Scales. Feminism is result-oriented. When dealing with social inequality, there are no neutral principles. Catherine McKinnon writes, when sex inequality is exposed as a naked power question, there is no separable question of what ought to be. In this shift of paradigms, equality propositions become no longer propositions of good and evil, but of power and powerlessness, no more disinterested in their origins or neutral in their arrival at conclusions than are the problems that they address. Kimberly Crenshaw, a member of the founder of critical race theory, describes this movement as grounded in a bottom-up commitment to improve the substantive conditions of minorities rather than on opposition to the use of race to interfere with the decisions that would otherwise be fair and neutral. On the right, public choice theorists are the heirs of Holmes. They see most legislation as the product of capture of the legislature by whatever group bid highest. Among the themes of public choice studies have been that laws ostensibly designed to prevent securities fraud were the product of a banker's fear of losing saving deposit, that the votes of federal judges on the constitutionality of the sentencing guidelines was strongly influenced by the judge's prospect of appointment to higher courts, that 19th century politicians deliberately allowed fires to run out of control so they could establish municipal fire departments and gain some patronage, that members of Congress have supported the creation of federal bureaucracies simply to gain support of constituents who would be treated unfairly by these bureaucracies. Of course, this is, you know, the most cynical view of politics you could possibly have, and I'm afraid it becomes truer and truer every day. Well, in their descriptions of common law doctrine and in their own normative writings, Law and economics scholars generally moderate this view of law as an unprincipled dogfight that characterizes their analysis of the work of legislatures and administrative agencies. The economists substitute the milder version of this skeptical creed, a perspective commonly described as applied utilitarianism. They do a lot of interest balancing. They've reduced it to a science with lots of formulas with Greek letters. But it's interesting that the most prominent of the law and economics scholars, Richard Posner, resists this characterization. Posner says that welfare economists seek the maximum satisfaction not of all human desires, but only of desires backed by wealth. And he suggests that by adding a wealth constraint to classical utilitarianism, he has made his moral relativism less troublesome than Jeremy Bentham's. In Bentham's utilitarian world, a sadist who derived enough pleasure from torture to outweigh his victim's suffering would be justified in tormenting her. Jeremy's joy could excuse Alice's anguish. But as Posner describes his own vision of justice, a sadist would have to buy his or her victim's consent, and these purchases would soon deplete the wealth of all but the wealthiest sadists. Well, the economists have their critics on the left, but these critics resist the idea that values are just there, just exogenous, and that's sort of the starting point for analysis. They say, well, values are socially constructed, and it's an appropriate function of law to shape human values. But, you know, that's the choice you get in the academy today, just their values, exogenous values, or socially constructed values. The idea that values might be right or wrong, that they could promote justice or, you know, the true happiness of human beings, that idea seems to be off the table. Well, as Arthur Leff summarized both Posner's bottom line and Bentham's, each of the seven deadly sins is as licit as any of the others and as any of the cardinal virtues. In the absence of any external source of value, all human desires have become the equivalent of one another. The pleasure of pulling the wings off flies ranks as high as feeding the hungry. For economically minded scholars, the function of law and other social institutions is to achieve the maximum satisfaction of human desires, regardless of their content, or if you like the Posner variation, the maximum satisfaction of desires backed by wealth. Well, without the possibility of God, writers like Posner see no escape from their moral skepticism. Yet their viewpoint falsifies everyday experience as much as it does religious tradition. As the theologian James Gustafson observes, people are valuing animals. They use their mental capacities to reflect about principles, duties, obligations, and end. They examine critically the objects of their valuation. They don't just rank desires on a scale of intensity. We do sense that some desires are not just stronger than others, but more worthy than others. And we struggle towards a proper ordering of the objects of desire. Now, the skepticism of welfare economists and utilitarians is only partial. They do attempt to put on the brakes before sliding into skeptical free fall. Although utilitarianism treats all desires as commensurable with all other desires, and although law and economics treats all desires as commensurable with money, utilitarianism does remain an ethical system. It's egalitarian, ranking everyone's happiness as highly as the king. It can demand altruism. If you're unhappy and old, you should certainly sacrifice your life to save a couple of young people who are happier than you are. But what makes this system just? Despite Jeremy Bentham's insistence that natural rights are simply nonsense on stilts, does even this homocentric ethical system require external justification? Can utilitarianism, wealth maximization, or any other ethical system make sense in the absence of God? Can you truly break skepticism halfway down? What's so great about egalitarianism, altruism, and human, or for that matter, hippopotamus satisfaction anyway? In the absence of any external justification, the desire that everybody's desires be satisfied is just another desire. Utilitarianism can be no more than a taste. Jeremy Bentham and his followers hope to maximize happiness. Richard Posner and his followers hope to maximize wealth. And Oliver Wendell Holmes preferred taking in hand life and trying to build a race. Different strokes for different folks. You know, you give up a lot when you give up on God. It seems to me that current legal scholars, by following Holmes, have tilted from Socrates on the issue that marks the largest and most persistent divide in all of jurisprudence. In Athens, 400 years before Christ, Socrates contended that justice was not a human creation, but had its origin in external reality. Thrasymachus disagreed. He insisted justice is nothing else but the interest of the stronger. And ethical skepticism has had its champions in the centuries that followed, but throughout Western history until the final third of the 19th century, the views of moral realists like Cicero, Gratian, Aquinas, Grotius, Pufendorf, Cook, Blackstone, Locke, and Lincoln dominated European and in later centuries American law. I think that the past century and a third has given moral relativism its longest sustained run in the Western history. And there really was a dramatic jurisprudential revolution that occurred in the final third of the 19th century after the end of the American Civil War and the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species. You'd still see talk of natural law in the last part of the 19th century, but it's mostly by people who began writing before the Civil War, the old guys. Virtually everybody who begins his writing about law after the Civil War disclaims any belief in natural law. It's suggested that the decline of societies has always coincided with a weakening or abandoning of the idea of natural law. I don't know whether that's true. I don't know whether intellectual movements shape society at all. But at the beginning of the 21st century, the nation's mood is sullen. The vices of atomism, alienation, ambivalence, and vacuity of commitment appear to be characteristic of our culture. Perry Farrell, the lead singer of Porno for Pyros, shouts the central lyric of American jurisprudence, ain't no wrong, ain't no right, only pleasure or pain. And perhaps amidst signs of cultural discouragement, you should expect to hear that lyric from orange-haired rock stars, as well as Judge Richard Posner. This skepticism of American law schools, I think, mirrors the skepticism of the academy as a whole. Many pragmatists abandoning the idea that human beings can perceive external reality, not just right, wrong, God, gravity, suffering, but even things like chairs. They maintain that the only test of truth is what works or what promotes human flourishing. At the end of a century of pragmatic experimentation, that standard has given us a clear answer. Pragmatism and moral skepticisms don't. They are far more conducive to despair than to flourishing. They fail their own test of truth. I do think things are changing. There is a resurgence of moral and philosophical writing about moral realism. Natural law does seem to be becoming respectable again. Maybe the image of returning is appropriate. A child's trust in her parents is likely to give way to adolescent rejection, and when the child becomes an adult, her adolescent rejection is likely to give way to a new and wiser appreciation of her parents' virtues. In the same way, lawyers of the 21st century may develop a new, more mature appreciation of their natural law heritage, a heritage that lawyers of the last century mostly dismissed as transcendental nonsense. And the iconoclasm and skepticism of the 20th century may give way to a new idealism and a new spirituality. Well, the transformation of American law that took place after the Civil War had a parallel in the transformation of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes during the Civil War. Holmes was not always as harsh a person as he became. Indeed, at Harvard College just before the Civil War, Holmes showed virtually no sign of the ethical skepticism that characterized his outlook in the decades after the war. His first published work, which appeared during his sophomore year, declared, "The highest conversation must address great questions of right and wrong and the relations of man to God." In his senior year, Holmes won $20 for the best undergraduate essay published in the University Quarterly. This essay criticized Plato, and when Holmes showed it to Ralph Waldo Emerson, Emerson returned it with the comment, "When you strike at a king, you must slay him." Although Holmes was critical of Plato, the mood of the essay was reverent. It spoke of the necessary ideas that exist permanently in the mind of the Creator, and it asserted that our intuitive faculty enabled us to recognize these necessary ideas. A third published essay, Notes on Albrecht Dürer, declared, "Higher than anything connected with the individual is the conception of a harmonious whole of a great work. And this again is great, just as its idea partakes of what is eternal. And the striving to look on eternal ideas is the highest gift of the artist." During his sophomore year, Holmes joined the Christian Union, a group whose membership was open to all students of good moral character without distinction of sect, claiming to believe in the truths of Christianity. Holmes was not an active member of the group, but he retained his membership because he said, "I wanted to bear testimony in favor of a religious society founded on liberal principles in distinction to the more orthodox and sectarian platform of the Christian Brethren." Holmes also had a moral crusade. He was an abolitionist. He wrote later that when I was a sophomore, that he was deeply moved by the abolition cause. When I was a sophomore, I didn't like the nigger minstrels because they seemed to belittle the race. Now I fear you would shudder at the level of some of my social beliefs. The Liberator noted a financial contribution by Holmes to the abolitionist cause. At the 1861 annual meeting of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, Holmes was one of a group of young men who served as bodyguards to Wendell Phillips, who Holmes's father described as a pestilent abolitionist. And when the war came in 1861, Holmes, then 20 years old, abandoned the final 2 months of his college studies and enlisted in the Massachusetts militia, risking the loss of his college degree. One of his biographers commented, "Doubtless the conviction that slavery was an intolerable evil in a civilized society played a critical part in Holmes's decision." Well, the three-year period that followed shaped Holmes's jurisprudence and personal outlook more than any other. Certainly wasn't a period when law was very much on his mind. 3 months after his enlistment, Holmes was commissioned a lieutenant in the 20th Massachusetts Regiment, and 3 months after that, he was seriously wounded in the chest at Ball's Bluff during his first intense combat. Bleeding freely from the mouth and expecting to die, he thought briefly of taking the laudanum his father had given him for use if the pain became unbearable. Within a year, he was wounded a second time. A bullet through his neck at Antietam Creek created a gaping hole, but the wound was less serious than it seemed. Within another year, there was a third wound, a ball into the heel at Chancellorsville. To Holmes's disappointment, his foot was not amputated. If his foot had been amputated, he wouldn't have had to fight anymore. Holmes' letters and war diary describe bouts of dysentery and scurvy, grueling labor, harsh physical conditions, long periods of boredom, senseless orders, and the horrors of war. "I remember a red blanket with an arm lying on it in a pool of blood. It seems to me as if instinct told me it was John Putnam's. And near the entrance of a surgeon calmly grasping a man's finger and cutting it off. It is singular with what indifference one gets to look on the dead bodies in gray clothes which lie around. As you go through the woods, you stumble constantly. And if after dark, as last night on picket, perhaps tread on the swollen bodies already fly-blown and decaying of men shot in the head, back, or bowels. Many of the wounds are terrible to look at. Well, we licked them. It's odd how indifferent one gets to the sight of death. perhaps because one gets aristocratic and don't value much a common life. Then they have to be so dirty it seems natural, dust to dust. I would do anything that lay in my power, but it doesn't much affect my feelings. Found woods afire and bodies of Rebs and our men just killed and scorching. Today is the seventh day we have fought, averaging a loss, I guess, of 3,000 a day at least. In the corner of the woods, the dead of both sides lay piled in the trenches 5 or 6 feet deep, wounded, often writhing under superincumbent dead. Before you get this, you will know how great the butcher's bill has been. I have not been and am not likely to be in the mood for writing details. Enough that these 2 weeks have contained all of the fatigue and horrors that war can furnish. Every regimental officer I knew or cared for is dead or wounded. Well, at the midpoint of Holmes' 3-year enlistment, slightly more than a year after his wounding at Ball's Bluff, and just 2 months after his wounding at Antietam, he voiced his disillusionment. I pretty much made up my mind that the South have achieved their independence, and I'm almost ready to hope spring will see an end. Believe me, we shall never lick them. The Army is tired with its hard and its terrible experience, and still more with its mismanagement. And I think before long the majority will say that we are vainly working in effect to effect what never happens, the subjugation, for that it is, of a great civilized nation. We shan't do it. At least the Army can't. A few months later, Holmes received a letter that tested his commitment to the abolition cause. Its author was Holmes's closest friend in college, Penn Hallowell. Hallowell was a Philadelphia Quaker who hated slavery more than he did war, and he left Harvard to enlist when Holmes did. The two classmates served together as officers of the 20th Massachusetts Regiment. Holmes' letters and diaries wrote that when Holmes' life hung in the balance at Ball's Bluff, Hallowell appeared and kissed him, that Hallowell fought like a brick in that engagement, that serving in the company Hallowell commanded made all the difference, and that the two officers spent hours waiting together for medical attention in a house that once fell behind enemy lines after both of them were wounded at Antietam. The letter that Holmes received from Hallowell in February 1863 concerned the formation of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, a regiment of African-American soldiers commanded by white officers. If you've seen the movie Glory, it's about the 54th Massachusetts. The governor of Massachusetts was recruiting officers from among young men of military experience and firm anti-slavery principles. Hallowell wrote Holmes, "Dear O.W., by a power as irresistible as fate, I am drawn into the colored regiment 54th as lieutenant colonel. Would you take the majority?" We don't have Holmes's response to Hallowell. Any reference that Holmes made to Hallowell's overture in letters to his family vanished when Holmes edited his Civil War letters and destroyed many of them. But as Mark DeWolf Howe concluded, it is probable that it was by his own choice that Holmes remained with the 20th. Hallowell may have approached Holmes once more. In July 1863, the 54th Massachusetts and a newer African-American regiment, the 55th, which Hallowell commanded, suffered overwhelming casualties in an unsuccessful assault on Fort Wagner. Attempting to fill the decimated ranks of officers of the two regiments, Hallowell may have attempted to enlist Holmes again. Holmes at the time was at home recuperating from his third war wound. A letter sent to Holmes by another of his very close friends, Henry Little Abbott, provides the principal evidence that Holmes again declined Hallowell's proposal. Abbott was a hero of the Battle of Fredericksburg who would soon receive a fatal wound in the Battle of the Wilderness. His politics differed from Hallowell and Holmes. He was no abolitionist. He, in the 20th Massachusetts Regiment, was known as the Copperhead Regiment. And Abbott's letter in October 1863 complimented Holmes on his decision to return to the 20th. "I believe you have done not only what is agreeable to yourself and to us, but what is thoroughly right and proper instead of wasting yourself before the shrine of the great nigger." Well, within another year, Holmes declined reenlistment. His regiment's losses had been greater than its original strength, and he wrote home, "I cannot now endure the labors and hardships of the line." Well, the passion that Holmes felt for the abolition of slavery before the Civil War faded during the war, turned to distaste after the war had ended. In a letter to Harold Lasky in 1930, Holmes wrote of Bertrand Russell, He seems to me in the emotional state not unlike that of the abolitionists in former days, which I then shared and now much dislike. Holmes had written to Lasky earlier, "You put your ideals or prophecies with the slight superior smile of the man who is sure he is the future. I have seen it before in the past, from the abolitionists to Christian Science." Of Leon Trotsky's autobiography, Holmes wrote, "I feel the tone I became familiar with in my youth among the abolitionists." He wrote that an account of the communists shows in most extreme form what I came to loathe in the abolitionists, the conviction that anyone who did not agree with them was a knave or a fool. You see the same in Catholics and in some of the dries apropos of the 18th Amendment. He was always comparing John Calvin on Catholics to abolitionists, or Catholics on John Calvin to abolitionists. So despite the triumph of a cause that had moved him deeply, Holmes came to regard his own passionate belief in that cause as vanity. And in fact, the post-war Holmes mocked the pre-war Holmes, this 20-year-old who was foolish enough to have causes. In 1864, explaining his decision not to re-enlist, Holmes wrote to his parents, "I am not the same man." And he truly was not. When Holmes began 20 years after leaving the Army to give speeches about his war experience, he appears to have experienced an odd inversion of values. He had reinterpreted his war experience as positive. In his memory, the mud-black, blood-red fields were transformed to white and gold. Holmes wrote, "Through our great good fortune and our youths, our hearts were touched with fire. We have seen with our own eyes, beyond and above the gold fields, the snowy heights of honor." In war, Holmes had touched the blue steel edge of actuality for half an hour and come close to truth. He declared, "Life is war, and the part of man in it is to be strong." His correspondents offered such comments as, "It did those chaps a lot of good to live expecting someday to die by the sword." He concluded that he had experienced life most fully in the years that he risked death, peril, exertion, violent struggle, and commitment in the teeth of danger. Those were the things that gave meaning to life and made it worthwhile. In 1895, Holmes gave an address, The Soldier's Faith, that brought congratulations from the man who had appointed him to the Supreme Court, Theodore Roosevelt. The address had a Darwinian cast. Moralists and philosophers declare that war is wicked, foolish, and soon to disappear. For my own part, I believe that the struggle for life is the order of the world at which it is vain to repine. The most noted passage of the address, the one that probably touched Roosevelt most deeply, revealed Holmes' glorification not only of war, but of blind commitment. In the midst of doubt, in the collapse of creeds, there is one thing I do not doubt, that no man who lives in the same world with most of us can doubt, and that is that the faith is true and adorable, which leads a soldier to throw away his life in obedience to a blindly accepted duty, in a cause which he little understands, in a plan of campaign of which he has no notion, and under tactics of which he does not see the use. In remarks throughout his life, Holmes gave the lie to the statements of his comrade in arms, William T. Sherman, "It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, and more destruction. War is hell." For Holmes, war was not life gone awry. It was life at its most meaningful. And this, as I've said, is the man who most shaped our current American law, more I think than any other American thinker. I guess I'll make just two concluding observations about his skepticism. First, Holmes hardly ever offered any arguments or analysis in support of his skeptical stance. When he said that he sneered at the rights of man, he described his method as well as his position. Skeptics are every bit as likely as believers to rely on assertion, maybe more so. And second, Holmes revealed that a skeptic who tries to avoid the precipice can make an existential leap to the right as readily as to the left. He saw more clearly than later skeptics the implications of his position. He didn't claim to believe in much. His existential leaps were short. Unlike successor skeptics, he didn't insist that he had deconstructed all extant categories of thought while still believing somehow in participation, in participatory democracy and redistribution and the intersubjective zap. To live is to function, he said. That is all there is to living. It was enough for him to have done a job. Then he could make fun of the onward and upwarders. Unlike many of his heirs later in the 20th century, Holmes had the courage of his non-convictions. So, any questions or comments? We have another half hour before the next speaker, yeah.
In light of the trend toward moral skepticism in legal theory that you talked about, how would you characterize a legal theory such as Ronald Dworkin, who argues that in addition to seeing the law as containing the explicit statutes, we should also see it as containing the morally best principles that would explain those statutes?
Well, I've read some Dworkin. I think he's a moral realist on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and a skeptic on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I mean, he claims to be a moral realist, but you read his papers on moral realism, and you don't see any grounding there. I mean, I can't make a lot of sense out of it on these ultimate issues. Yeah.
What was Holmes' influence on his fellow jurists during the time he was on the Supreme Court? Was he really
No, one of the reasons he's remembered as a great justice is that he was thought to be right on the two great constitutional issues of his time when the rest of his court was wrong. I mean, the court is striking down all of, the state of New York says it's inhuman for bakers to work 14 hours a day, we'll pass a maximum 10-hour day, and the Supreme Court strikes it down as a violation of freedom of contract over Holmes' dissent. He oddly says, the 14th Amendment does not enact Mr. Herbert Spencer's social statics, which is odd since he was the only real social Darwinist on the court. But he believed that the legislature should have its way. He thought this was perfectly foolish legislation, wouldn't accomplish anything for anybody, but that was what the dominant power wanted to do. And he was an equal opportunity skeptic. I mean, it would buck against Bell if people passed legislation favoring the sterilization of imbeciles, he would support that as well. So that was one issue, and history has vindicated his stand. At least I still have colleagues across the Midway who think that the Lochner case striking down the wages and hours legislation was rightly decided, but most people don't. Most people think Holmes's position was correct, and he was also these First Amendment dissents during World War I. People like Eugene V. Debs would give speeches that don't look at all subversive today, and the court would lock them up for 10 years. And Holmes, he actually went through a switch. I mean, it's really switching one Darwinian metaphor for another. He starts out being very repressive on free speech issues, but he does this remarkable switch in 1919 and writes this wonderful dissenting opinion in Abrams against the United States. And the story of how he switched it's really moving from one Darwinian metaphor, the power of the dominant power in the political process, to another Darwinian metaphor, the power of speech to get itself accepted in the marketplace of ideas. And it's partly the influence of a lot of young Jewish guys on the Harvard Law School faculty. I mean, Holmes has no children of his own. And here are these really bright guys who are sort of paying a lot of attention to him, and they want to treat him as a liberal. And I mean, there are a lot of other influences. Brandeis is on the Supreme Court, and you can write a lot of pages, and I have, about why he changes his position. But no, he doesn't have a lot of influence with his fellow justices. But he does today.
Okay. How did that work itself into the system?
How does what work?
How did his influence, if it didn't come into through his decisions?
Well,
just a growing movement within the law, or was there a way that he expressed himself, in fact, did insert himself?
Well, of course, the legal realists of the 1920s and 1930s took Holmes as their hero. People like Jerome Frank and Carl Llewellyn. And these were, you know, extraordinarily skeptical. They were more skeptical than Holmes was. I mean, they didn't believe in law at all. You know, law was pretense. It was all what the judge had for breakfast. Every judge should get himself psychoanalyzed because the law was all superstructure. But they took this essay, The Path of the Law. I mean, I really think that was the essay was more influential than the judicial work. I mean, this sort of positivist view of law. Law is what law does. What's duty? Duty is a prediction that if you do something, the law will bring some sanction to bear on you. And that's all it is. You know, when I went to law school, that was the way we were trained. You know, you start saying duty, that means you shouldn't do it. What do you mean shouldn't? You mean the law is going to come down on you? I think it's an upside down view of law. You first think about what's right and wrong, and then you decide what the sanctions ought to be, not the other way around. But this sort of hard-edged view of law is what I learned in law school, and I think most people learn in law school. Yeah?
I realize it would be something of speculation, but could you speculate about what Holmes would say about contemporary questions about the Supreme Court of constitutional interpretation? It struck me as you were describing, particularly these last things you described, that ironically all that would have a very different sense of what the law is about. And he almost sounded Scalia-esque in saying, look, these bodies want to pass laws, and you don't have anything to
right.
Within our text that says they can't.
Well, that was certainly his view. I mean, he was a strong champion of judicial restraint, not just from a reading of the Constitution, which is Scalia's basis, but from this sort of Darwinian viewpoint that the dominant power should have its way. And it's tough to be a judge when you don't believe in right and wrong. I mean, it would not seem an auspicious job choice for somebody who's how do you decide cases? Well, you come up with these Darwinian metaphors. You know, what does the majority of the legislature have to do with Darwin? Nothing. I mean, they don't really have the guns. The majorities have rarely had the guns over the course of human history. But Holmes sort of had to. That was the closest he could come to a metaphor. And yes, so it led to judicial restraint when it was appropriate, as in the Lochner case on maximum hours for bakers, and maybe when it wasn't, as in Buck against Bell. Yeah. That's an interesting question. I think that if you get to most folks in the electorate, they would be appalled by Holmes's moral views. This was not in fact any majority sentiment. It's the sentiment, but it is the sentiment that I think dominates the academy. Within the conservative movement, you can certainly find great skeptics like Judge Posner. You can find religious believers like Mike McConnell. And there's a very different approach to judging. I mean, Posner writes books about his pragmatism. He doesn't care about the text. He thinks Bush against Gore was rightly decided. Holmes would never have decided Bush against. I mean, would have thought the idea of the Supreme Court deciding an election was appalling. But Posner says, well, the reason Bush against Gore is right is he goes through this elaborate scenario which tosses the election into the House of Representatives, and there's this stalemate, and there won't be effective government, maybe it's one scenario, Strom Thurmond, who's president pro tem of the Senate, becomes president. And, he wants to avoid all of that, so the court just has to take it over and forget about what the Constitution has to say about it. I mean, he doesn't quite say forget about what the Constitution has to say about it, you're always thinking about consequences. and not about the text in the Posnerian viewpoint. You want me to stop?
I think we're going to have to.
Okay.
And let me take the privilege of asking one last question.
Okay.
You clearly made a change in opposition to this legal pragmatism, legal skepticism. Can you say a little bit about what prompted you in a setting, in a legal climate today that seems to be overwhelmingly skeptical and pragmatic? What question started occurring to you that said there's something else here?
I don't know. I think I always reacted negatively to it. I mean, I remember I was on the Harvard Law Review my third year, and we did this collective note. Everybody did a note on developments in the law, and we all, you know, big group of us worked on it. It was all of this functional analysis of this, that, you know, when you could steal the other guy's invention, when you couldn't. And I wrote a parody of it about, you know, in the setting it in the 13th century, when you should be able to steal the other guy's physical property. I mean, I've always been uncomfortable. The more interesting question is how I became a Christian, because I wasn't always a Christian. There were a lot of things that went into that. I mean, I converted to Christianity at the age of 48. I think a part of it was my sense, part of it was the professional stuff. You know, the sense that law that is not grounded on a strong sense of right and wrong is lousy law. I think a lot of things came together when I became a Christian, and that was certainly one part of it.